Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. How's your lawn looking these days? Looks like we're finally on the other side of the hottest days of the summer. Cross your fingers. But my lawn looks like Baja California. It's not even a lawn. It's just a brown patch of dirt with some patches of hardy weeds there. So does that make me a bad person? There's this American ideal that keeping up appearances with a lush green lawn is important. But why is that? Some say the lawns are a waste of water and the chemicals that pollute the environment, you got to pump on them. What's behind this love affair that we have with our front yard meadow? Tell your lawn story. Are we going to draw a line in the St. Augustine and declare our allegiance to green grass, or are we going to start calling on saws on our neighbors for not following the water restrictions? We invite you into our conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. You could also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. We're joined this half hour by Paul Robbins. He's the director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin. He's the author of the book Lawn People, How Grasses, Weeds, and Chemicals Make Us Who We Are. Paul, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me on.
Why are lawns so important to, is it an American phenomenon?
Well, of course, it's not an original American landscape. It was imported, and so are all the grasses. Almost all the grasses, turf grasses in the U.S. on most people's lawns are invasive exotics. You know, they come from Europe and Africa and Asia. So it came over with the settlers, but it wasn't a big deal until, you know, American post-war economic real estate boom. So it is American in that sense, and yet it's sort of utterly alien, especially in Texas and California.
I'm always thinking about those exterior shots of, I guess, Leave It to Beaver, the Cleaver household, or the Brady Bunch house, and they always have the beautiful grass, but then on the close-up, you can tell that it's AstroTurf in the backyard of the Brady Bunch's house. Was that an influence?
Oh, sure. I think television, there's all kinds of things that sort of made it normal in America. I think television was profoundly impactful. You know, back in the 1920s, had we had television, you wouldn't have seen any lawns. It was before, you know, there was enough land to put lawns on. But in the real estate boom, it coincided with television. People had more access to seeing things like golf, and baseball stadiums still fill me with awe when I see that carefully cut outfield. I'm almost moved myself, and I have a big problem with lawns. So I think a lot of things combined culturally, but I do think it was the kind of middle class neighborhood of the 50s, 60s, and 70s that cemented this thing into place.
Yeah, but it's there was something already there in the American DNA that really was drawn to that, and that this was the ideal. And I'm wondering if it's the great lawn of the landowner in England and in Ireland, and you know, you want to recreate that feeling of that you are a person of land.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think when people began to settle the suburbs, again, fairly late on, they wanted their own piece of land to manage. But keep in mind, they could have managed that in a bunch of different ways. They could have put food on the land, or they could have put something else on the land. There's something about being a consumer citizen in the late 20th century, in the early 21st century, which makes it a little different. But that's true. The gentry, the elite in the 1800s would have been the only people could have lawns. I mean, think about what it would take to just cut a lawn, maybe 1 acre of lawn, if you didn't have a lawnmower. It takes peasants. So that, you bet, that's an elite aesthetic. But it's made very simple, you know, by 1955 or 1960 to reproduce that. So I wouldn't want to overstate the manor house culture. I think it has a lot to do with community. People in America, they were settled in these neighborhoods together. They looked at each other. They were looking across the fence, or if there was a fence at all. So I think part of it is about a fairly recent phenomenon of land settlement in the U.S., the suburbs and the areas past the streetcars in the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah, but you're not creating a commons. It's very much a sense of this is my lawn, get off it.
But it's so funny that, because, right, of course it's your own land, and I can do whatever the heck I want, right? I mean, that's a very reasonable private landowner and very American notion of property. It's my, and yet, if you don't manage the lawn the way your neighbors like it, they are going to tell you you're letting the team down. They certainly did to me when I lived in Ohio. you know, my whole adventure was set off by my next door neighbor complaining about the creeping Charlie, which is, I thought, a very pleasant minty leaf, but it turns out to be a terrible, terrible weed, right?
There are about 3,000 different plants that are called creeping Charlies.
There you go. Thank you. See, so they're almost inevitable. They're the only thing natural. They're indigenous. So what's crazy, right, is that, in fact, it is a commons. We wouldn't like to think so because we're private property owners. But the pressure you're under, and that's not just social pressure, right? There are homeowners association rules. There are municipal laws that tell you what height you can keep your grass at. So it's about maintaining a commons in a free market world where we are supposed to be sovereign owners of the land. But in fact, right, we always are tangling with the authorities and tangling with our community if we do something that doesn't quite live up to, you know, standards.
Up to code compliance.
Literally up to code. Literally.
All right, let me get a caller in on this. Our number is 210-614-8980. We're talking about lawns, the past, the present, the future, particularly as we're going into permanent water restrictions. Let's get George on the air. Hey, George, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing good.
Well, I just don't understand how, in the context of where we have a lot of water restriction, right now you can drive in the city and lots of very nice parts of the city, and if they're actually keeping to the water restriction rules, their lawns look like H-E-L-L. And the reality is that in the Southwest, those kinds of lawns just don't fit. Hey, if you're up north in the Northeast and you've got the waterfall and, you know, in England, Germany, wherever, it makes a lot of sense. But frankly, we've got, you know, wonderful wildscape plants in the Southwest that could do some wonderful things. And we have native grasses that could easily. So if you really are dying for a lawn, there's a possibility for a lawn. But, I mean, Bermuda grass here? Give me a break. It's like $4 gas and you're buying a gas guzzler. It doesn't make any sense.
All right, George, thanks for calling in. So, Paul, are people in America redefining their relationship with their lawn?
So, great. George is so on the money about this. So I lived in Tucson for many years before I came up here to Wisconsin. And there haven't been lawns in Tucson, appreciably large lawns, in several decades. I was told they all came out in the early 1970s, long before I got there. And there's xeriscaping, and there's giant saguaro cacti, and it's really quite beautiful and quite appropriate, locally appropriate. Now, if you drive up the road to Phoenix, for whatever reasons of settlement history or politics, who knows what, Phoenix still has lots and lots of lawns. I think it probably has a great deal to do with water access and water rights, which allow flood irrigation of some people's properties, which I don't think we see in Tucson anymore. My point about this, going back to George, is that things do change. A whole city basically abandoned lawns at some point. And then at the same time, in some places, things don't change. And these are two cities separated by, you know, 100 miles.
Sure, and there are all sorts of institutional reasons, people who want to make sure that we keep lawns and want to water lawns, and we have to wonder what about is there enough water for that in our future? We're going to keep talking about the future of lawns with the author of the book, Lawn People, How Grasses, Weeds, and Chemicals Make Us Who We Are. We invite you into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. We'll be back with Paul Robbins when we come back from this one-minute break. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The green, green grass of home. Could the American love affair with the lush lawn be coming to a close? Why do we have this fixation with the front yard meadow? It sucks up water and demands fertilizer, and that runoff produces dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico. But are you still a lawn person? You're willing to break water restrictions for that span of green pasture right outside of your front door? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, and we're speaking with the author of the book, Lawn People, Paul Robbins. And let's get some callers on the air. Byron is called in. Byron, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Water usage is a concern of mine, so we have a drought-tolerant Bermuda grass at our house, and it holds the dirt together very well. We're on clay, and without that grass, my ground cracks really badly, and then the wind and the rain remove my yard, which can cause damage to my home. So what do we have for alternatives to grass and to keep our foundation safe?
Okay, Byron, that's a good question. You raise a great point there, Paul. He's seeing grass and lawn as a very practical issue.
Yeah, it's terrifically practical. I mean, there are, I won't contradict this, that, you know, you can't just have in many places bare soil, particularly where you do have major rain events, like in Tucson. Again, the monsoon carries off a tremendous amount of soil, so it's always good to have something that holds it down. I am not an expert on the ecology of Texas, but I would say that probably there's terrific extension agents out there throughout the Texas counties and out of the, you know, out of the ag schools, who could tell you all kinds of appropriate ground covers which are low, you know, not water demanding or less water demanding. And it may be that the St. Augustine that's there is, you know, appropriate and defensible. I would never, you know, I wouldn't presume to say. So you are balancing something. You are trying to keep land cover on the ground. There's nothing wrong with green things. And in fact, people in Phoenix make a reasonable argument that grass tends to cool the urban heat island, so it has certain kinds of positive effects and externalities. The question is about trade-offs. How much do you want to pay in grass and capital and money to get the same benefit that you might get in a more sustainable, less intensive way? And it's a puzzle, but it's one that I think we've learned to solve in a lot of arid places. So there's a lot of knowledge out there. There's smart people at the universities and working for the municipalities who actually can help you puzzle that out, and I'd consult them.
Another caller, get Jody on the air. Jody, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to say, you know, I've really taken advantage of, I moved to San Antonio in 2008, really took advantage of the SAWS programs, took out my entire backyard, all the grass out there, and put in native species and kind of xeriscaped it on my own. I did the same thing for the front patch, and I absolutely love it. You know, I get hummingbirds and butterflies and bees, and it's really wonderful. And we don't, you know, maybe I'll water it once a month during the summer months just to kind of, you know, save the plants a little bit. But I think that, you know, one of the ways that we might consider saving water is to encourage the developers to, when they're creating the neighborhoods, to maybe xeriscape the lawns to begin with, and, you know, to show people how pretty they can be and how they can save water. And maybe if the city would do some kind of incentive program for the developers, so they're not just, you know, just continue building these homes with the lawns that, you know, are sucking up all this water. I do a lot of volunteer work with Texas Parks and Wildlife, and I'm really cognizant of how the rivers go up and down. And when I heard that people saying, oh, we're out of the drought earlier this year, I was like, oh, my God, these people are going to be watering the lawns and, you know, wasting all this water. It drives me crazy to see my neighbors out there with their Bermuda grass, you know, just spending, you know, hours out there watering their lawn.
Okay, Jody, thanks for the call. So let's go ahead and get another caller on this with Mike. We've got so many callers. Let's get them on the air. Mike, hi. Welcome to The Source.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the author's comments on the difference between Tucson and Phoenix. I had lived in Tucson and had gravel. It was wonderful. I never had to mow a yard. I didn't have to do, we had drip irrigation for desert plants. And Tucson, I believe, is three times the size of Scottsdale. Scottsdale uses three times as much water. So that was my comment. I would love to xeriscape or just have gravel here, but it's the quickest way to make an HOA go insane.
Right.
They do not like xeriscaping.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mike, thank you for your call. So, Paul, these two callers brought up a great point. It's about modeling, that if we were able to see people doing this in a beautiful way in that didn't use the St. Augustine grass, then it would be easier for other homeowners to adopt those practices.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think part of the reason – so there's two things, right? Part of it is modeling the behaviors. When we see our neighbors mow – this is true everywhere I've lived that's had grass – when the next-door neighbor mows – I realize I have to get up and mow because actually now the grass heights are offset from one another, which is frowned upon. So if you reverse that weird logic and you model better, more interesting, more biodiverse behavior, it makes it a lot safer for other people to follow suit. We have, I believe, a municipal law here, a code that was adopted many years ago in Madison, which is kind of a freedom to farm right, which says you got the freedom to not have lawn. And it makes it harder for people to sue you. So based upon that very notion, right, that that you can model better behavior. But the earlier call, Jody made a really good point, which is that the developer, most of us don't actually put our lawns in, right? We buy a house, and it's already there. The developer makes these choices. And developers could make much more interesting choices. You know, they would say, hey, there's no market. But
then these developers do have to follow city rules as they, they put these things together, right, and do the platting and what have you. And they're still, at least here locally, they're allowed to put in lawn irrigation systems when they do the development. And I think that's just inviting more water wasting.
Well, I wouldn't dispute that. And so you follow the kind of chain of explanation. Okay, I'm making bad decisions. Why? Well, I've inherited this bad lawn. Well, why? The developers put it in. Well, why? Because we have certain kinds of municipal codes, because of history of development, because, in fact, putting turf grass down, believe it or not, is one of the cheapest things a developer can do. They've already carted off most of the good soils when they lay the ground for construction. They've actually taken away the A-horizon soils, those surface soils that may be rich and laid down historically. So, in fact, grass is easy for them. And then they just walk away and you've got the house. So, yeah.
Okay, another caller, Sarah. And Sarah, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm going to be a bit of a devil's advocate here. I live in San Antonio, and I live in an area that has lots and lots of lush green lawns and big oak trees, and I completely follow all of the SAW's restrictions once a week. We have drip irrigation for our landscaping areas. And the way that I kind of feel like I'm still doing my part is we actually put in solar on our house. And, whenever you produce electricity through coal power plants, they use a lot of water as well. And by producing solar, we are actually counteracting a little bit what water we're using for our lawn. But we've gotten real smart about it. You know, we put in the rotator instead of the regular sprinklers. We also, because we've got the clay soils, we put it on a cycle where it waters for 10 minutes and rests for an hour and waters for 10 minutes again. So there's no runoff, but it gets a really good, deep watering. And, you know, you don't have to make it's not black or white when it comes to green lawns in San Antonio. And I think one of the things that we really benefit from is our neighborhood is well established. It's been there a long time. And we don't do things like the chemicals that you put down. We put down compost at the beginning of every spring to nourish our lawn. So you don't have to, it's not black and white.
All right, Sarah, thank you so much for calling in. We love devil's advocates, and you raise a great point, many good points. So, Paul, let me ask you about that, because do we have to shame people for having green lawns? If as long as there's water and they're willing to pay for it, what's wrong with it?
Yeah, right. I actually think shaming is really bizarre. I mean, it's in a sense a direct inversion of the previous problem, was that if somebody felt like not having a lawn or letting it go or doing something funky, they were the ones who were pilloried or often taken to court over their behaviors. And now what we've done, at least in California, I can't speak for Texas, is invert that whole story. So now somebody puts lawn in. Maybe they're making really responsible choices, as the caller clearly is, or they have good geography in the sense that the soils are right. Tucson soils are very sandy, for example. You put water on them, that just goes right out the bottom. Clay soils behave differently. If they got good geography, they got a good plan, maybe they're doing the right thing. Why would you want to shame them? I think the problem isn't so much the grass, because the grass, whatever. It's actually that the grass always stands in for something else. People are usually going after each other to maintain property values or a sense of community or whatever it is when they shame one another or they sue one another. And it often becomes about the lawn, but actually the deeper problem is something else in the moral fabric of the community, an argument over something more heartfelt, but also okay, more abstract.
I'm going to get last caller on. Sandra has called in. Sandra, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I just want to make a comment sort of briefly about the whole developers and the lawn option. The city of San Antonio actually requires by code that builders or developers offer Xeriscape as an option. It's actually been in existence for years now. They're required to offer it to, home buyers from the onset, and then also to have a Xeriscape sort of plan display to show their potential buyers as well, but it's very difficult, from my understanding, to enforce.
Okay, Sandra, thanks for telling us about that. Appreciate that good information. So, Paul, we're seeing that there is options available, especially when the cities get involved.
Yeah, San Antonio sounds like paradise.
It is, so, let me tell you, it is.
So there you go.
But we saw recently just in California, when the Governor Brown told them you need to cut back on water usage, they cut back like a 33% in no time at all. So we've shown that once that there's a lot of room for conservation when people realize that this is a precious resource and we need to take care of it. So, Paul, thank you so much for joining us. His book is Lawn People, How Grasses, Weeds, and Chemicals Make Us Who We Are. And he's also the director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning us in. This is The Source on KSTX.